there's a lot of agriculture, potato fields and broccoli fields up in way up in northern Maine. And we used to hunt bear up there a lot in the fall. We used to go up with Kirk Rogers and Jimmy Osgood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know, like that big bear behind me right here, that weighed 502. I shot that one with Kirk and Jimmy.
Nice. And,
yeah, dogs bait him up on the ground. And so that, yeah, I got two of them over 500 of those guys. And they had the best bear dogs anybody I ever hunted with. Those guys are both phenomenal hound trainers. They run walkers.
Yep.
And phenomenal hound, great guys to hunt with. I recommend everybody that wants to do a bear hunt that asks me about a bear hunt, I just send them to Kirk.
Yeah. Me and Kirk's trying to work some stuff out for sure on that.
Welcome to my podcast, where we are going to talk about a lifestyle with dogs and throw in a few life lessons along the way. Whether you're a hound hunter, a bird dog enthusiast running setters, pointers, retrievers, or a flat-out running dog junkie, this podcast is for you. I am your host, Heath Hyatt, a certified law enforcement canine trainer with over 3 decades of personal and professional training and handling experience. It's time for me to pay it forward. So grab your leads, lace up those boots, and come and join me on this lifelong process of teaching, training, and learning all types of hunting dogs. Do you like to be outdoors like I do? Hunting, fishing, hiking? If so, OnX is the app for you. I've been a loyal OnX user since 2013. It's the one app I can honestly say I use daily. While hunting, I know where I'm at all times. I mark trails, feeding, bedding areas, and the list goes on. When I'm traveling, I use it to pre-scout all the new places that I'm blessed to hunt. While out west hiking Yellowstone, I knew exactly where every trail went and the difficulty of each one. And here's a secret. I even use it to mark my favorite fishing spots. It's been a game changer at work. I've used it numerous times to get in touch with property owners. I even landed MedFlight one time in the middle of nowhere using the GPS coordinates. OnX has so many great features and tools, you can literally use it for everything. It is by far the best mapping app on the market. So get started with OnX today using K920. That's the letter K, number 920, and know where you stand.
We've got we got 6 inches already. So
here, what, March 23rd? Yeah.
Yeah. But that's normal for Maine, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, we always get a couple of late storms that really, the heaviest storms come in March and April.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what was it, 2 weeks ago, it was 60, 70 degrees for like 4 days in a row, and it melted all the snow, the ice. The ice went out of the lakes here the earliest I've ever seen them in my life. I mean, they never go out till April, and they've been ice-free for 2 weeks.
All right, guys, this was a hard one to track down. When I use the word track, like, that's what we're going to be talking about today is tracking, all forms of tracking, hound tracking and visual tracking, and I'm pretty honored to be able to get this guest on. A lot of you may not know who he is, and it was brought to me through another podcast platform. I had one of my good friends up in New York, Ben, send me a podcast called Hunting Suburbia. And I'm like, why is he sending me this? And anyway, when it popped up, and I'd never seen this guy's name before. And when it popped up and I started listening to it, I'm like, oh, I'm getting more interested, more interesting. And by the end of it, I was like, I've got to talk to him. I've got to talk to him. I want to pick his brain. I want to hear all the things that he's done. So for the big introduction, I'm going to let him do it, but I'm going to tell you, we have Rick Labby on from Maine, and he is a common voice on the Big Woods Buck podcast. He's on there pretty regularly. I caught him on Hunting Suburbia is where I actually caught the first podcast and have listened to several now. And I was listening to the podcast. He was talking about coyote hunting with dogs. And he was talking about bear hunting with dogs. And then he mentioned Kirk Rogers, who, you know, we've had on. Kirk and I have talked a lot since then. And it intrigued me. And what the vision for me was is a learning point. So Rick, and I'm going to let him talk about it because this is his niche, not mine. But he literally tracks these northern bucks visually. And when I was very young into my hound career and didn't have dogs worth a nickel and was learning myself, every time it snowed, I took that opportunity to follow tracks from daylight till dark. And I learned so much about the animal that I was pursuing by following those tracks. And then once I had thought about it even more, like when we had snow days in school, when I was in high school, me and my brother would always go try to find a flock of turkeys and track them down. And that's something we'd done when we were younger. And that was our easiest way to kill a turkey back then in the fall, not the spring. And anyway, so all this just comes together. Again, I'm honored. Rick, tell us about you, who you are. And I know that like you hunt all over the country. Just tell us a little bit about that before we start diving into the tracking.
All right. Yeah. Great to be on here, Heath. I'm glad you called me. But yeah, so I'm Rick Labby from Maine, and I'm a team member of Big Woods Bucks with Hal Blood. Maybe some of you guys heard of Hal Blood. And I've been a deer tracker my entire life. Since I was probably 11 years old, I started following bucks on snow, and nobody in my entire family ever tracked deer. If I look back through the history, they were all pretty much just maybe still hunters or hunting out of a tree stand or whatnot. So I kind of started learning how to track on my own when I was about 11 years old. And to jump back before that, when I was 7 years old, this fella named Dick Drysdale came to Maine, and he rented a camp next door to my grandfather. And I spent most of my time down at my grandfather's house when I was a kid. And Dick was a hound hunter. He moved up here from Texas. So my grandfather and him, my grandmother came from Texas. So they got talking in a store or something downtown one day and brought up Texas. And that sparked my grandfather's interest. So he says, yeah, I got a cabin. I'll rent you. So they rented that cabin next door. And when I was 7 years old, I was pretty lucky. I look back on it now, and Dick didn't know anybody around, and my grandfather wasn't really a hound hunter, didn't care about it. So Dick asked me, he says, you want to go coon hunting with me? I said, sure. So here I was, 7 years old, and I was carrying a .22 Ruger single six pistol, and which was my grandfather's at the time. I bought one later, and I was climbing 40, 50, 60 foot pine trees, 7, 8, 9 years old, and Dick would always tell me, don't you tell your mother, because she'll never let you go again. So I had to keep that a secret. And but we'd go out and we'd try to kill 8 or 10 coons every single night. I had to be home by midnight because it was all school nights except for Friday and Saturday night. Saturday had to be done at midnight. So that's kind of how I got into my hound hunting. Was at 7 years old, Dick started taking me. And he and I, we hunted all through the years until I was 18, 19, graduated high school. And then I kind of went off on my own, started my business. And Dick kind of shied away from bear hunting a little bit because we used to run bear hounds. Back then, you could run bear dogs in the spring in Maine. So we would run bear all spring and summer. And then it was bait hunting during the fall. So the season was a lot different than what it is now. So that's how I learned how to hound hunt, and was through Dick. And then all through the years, from the time I was 7, we used to bobcat hunt in Maine in the winter. So he had a blue tick. His name was Max. And we killed quite a few cats with that dog back when I was just a kid. It was we had a lot more snow back then than we do now. Now we have snow conditions have changed over the years. They're, we get a lot of storms and then it'll turn to rain, so it crusts, so you can't run a hound on crust. So as our cat hunting days are limited now, we had 8 days we ran this year, and I killed 6 cats with my buddy Sandy in 8 days. So we did all right. We got some pretty good hounds.
But yeah, I knew you told me that you were cat hunting. You to wait till the end of season so you could get caught up.
And now it's snowing today, but cat season's over. So we got a foot of snow coming right now. But yeah, so all through the years I've hunted with hounds my whole life, and I think that's kind of what got me intrigued with tracking deer, was hunting with hounds. Basically, you're tracking your game, you're looking for tracks, you're trying to age those tracks. You know, from the time I was a young kid, I was always trying to age tracks, and the older guys that I hunted with were teaching me how to age tracks back then. I didn't know nothing at 7. And so as I started deer hunting, the first snowstorm we got, I remembered, I'm going to follow this buck, see where he went. You know, I was like 11 years old. So, and I killed my first big buck when I was 13. So for 2 years, I followed him. And when I was 14, I killed another one. 15, I killed another one, always on snow. So that kind of hooked me right there on tracking on snow versus sitting in a tree stand waiting for a buck to come by. And it's hard to explain, but it's more about the following the track to me that intrigues me so much. It's really not about just killing the buck. It's more about following the track and kind of outsmarting that deer and unravel his routine on what he does. And maybe you won't kill him the first day, but I usually, every buck is different. They're just like people. Every single buck's got a little trait that's different than the next one or the next one. And so you kind of learn throughout the day tracking him. Look, like you might jump him and he goes to the left, you know, more than he does to the right when he runs. And I learned over the years that when I get on a buck like that and he went left twice, the next time I jump him, I would run to the left and try to get to an opening or something. Or in Maine, we get a lot of logging roads and you know, not really clear cuts, but just kind of open areas in the woods. And you might jump him in a thick spot. And if you just run sometimes 100 feet, you'd have a shot. So I shot a lot of bucks leaving the track when I jumped him and run, and then I'd get a look at them. And people say, well, how do you know how big of a buck it was? So that's all by the track, the size of the track and the width of that buck's gait that he's walking in. Because I look for a buck that's probably like 8 inches wide. That's a mature buck when they're about 8 inches wide on the distance between their hooves when they're walking. And you get a buck that's narrow in that. Some bucks, you'll see them, they'll walk in front of each other, kind of a longer stride. That usually tells me that's a younger deer, like a 3.5, maybe even a 4.5-year-old. But so most of the bucks I've killed in my life, I feel they're all 5.5 and older. I mean, some as old as probably 9 or 10. But so that's how we age our deer. You don't always get big horns here in Maine, because I hunt up north mostly, and a lot of the northern deer, the getting through the winter takes the nutrients out of their bodies. So they're rebuilding that all spring and summer instead of growing antlers. Whereas the further south you get, the deer are in better shape. They have warmer temperatures, less snow, easier winters, and they'll grow bigger racks, you know. So that's kind of the way that goes.
So let's talk about the tracking before we start talking. We backtrack to the dog part.
Yeah.
Because like I said, when I opened this up, like I learned more about the animal that I was pursuing, and I was not as fortunate. I didn't kill a lot of stuff. I was young, learning. Our terrain's a little different. It's, you know, it's up and down, and
yeah,
you know, a lot of, I didn't realize it because I was young at the time, but how much the wind played effect on what I did. And now looking at it, you know, 30 years later, I'm like, yeah, if I would have learned about the wind, I'd have probably killed some really nice bucks. But
yeah, I'd have killed triple what I've killed if I'd learned about the wind when I was younger.
Yeah, I mean,
no, there was nobody to teach me or you or whatever back then that had the knowledge that I do back then and that mm-hmm. I hunted. Right.
Yeah.
About the wind, yeah.
And when I teach, you know, I teach a lot of classes, and that's one thing I teach when I, and especially when I'm teaching like canine classes and stuff, is you can't teach experience. Like no. Some of the things that you just take for granted because you've done it or seen it 50,000 times, and you forget to bring it up or mention it, but you cannot teach experience. It's a learned.
It's almost thing. Like muscle memory.
Yeah.
You and I take it for granted, right? Mm-hmm. Something mm-hmm. that we've done over and over and over and for years and years, and you don't think about it until somebody else says to you, what'd you just do? Or how'd you do that again? And you go, oh, wow. Yeah, that is something that, you know, I can teach people that actually works, because you take it for granted. You've done it so much.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the things that you learn by tracking animals that you would say that stands out to you? Like, when we roll back this back into the dogs, I'm going to tie it together. But what are some things that stand out to you when you're tracking? And I'm going to post this, because just looking at the deer behind you are phenomenal. And I know when I heard you on the Suburbia podcast, you were saying what's a normal, like what's a good buck for Northern Maine?
Oh, a really good buck for Northern Maine is like a 140-inch deer, but they're way over 200.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this year I killed my 45th 200-pound buck, but, you know, that's my whole life. That's including Saskatchewan, Alberta, Ontario. I've hunted almost every province in Canada and 17 or 18 different Western states
mm-hmm.
in my life. And so I've been and seen a lot of country, a lot of terrain, and I've learned a lot doing it about animals. And and one thing I want to bring up is being brought up in Maine and in the thick cover and woods, I think Maine is one of the hottest places to hunt I've ever been. I mean, you might hunt a week here and only see one or two bucks in an entire week. So when I go out west, it just seems easy to me. It seems so easy to hunt whitetails out west, because it's more open. And if you pay attention to the wind and the terrain, you know, and I always say when I go out west, I take one day and I basically scout and hunt, maybe figure out where there is a big buck, and I usually kill him the next day. Most of the trips I go on, I usually kill an elk or a buck by the second or third day once I figure an area out. So, and I think once you've done that, it all kind of ties together. And it is hard to explain, but it's just years and years and years of experience with big game animals, and they all kind of interact the same. So once you learn those habits, you go to a new spot and you can kind of, you know, put 10 or 12 miles on hiking the first day, and once I locate a big buck or a big elk or whatever, then I usually hone in and I try to kill him the next day or two. So mm-hmm. yeah, whereas in Maine, the woods are so thick up here and noisy and all that and we got a lot of swamps and bogs. You got a lot of water we have to deal with. So getting close to a big buck in Maine is an art. It took me years to really learn how to track a buck and shoot him in his bed, and which I haven't shot that many in his bed, but actually get up close enough to him, jump him out of the bed and get a shot while they're running away and catch him off guard. And the wind is a huge factor, but you have no control over the wind when you're tracking, because that buck's going to go where he's going to go, and you got to stay on his track no matter what. So people ask me, they say, do you pay attention to the wind when you're tracking? Yeah, I do pay attention to the wind, because if it's at my back, I know he's just going to stay ahead and smell me, but he's only going to go in a straight line so far, and he's going to kind of get out of his range, because every big buck's got a range they're comfortable with, a territory, because they know the woods like we do our house. So eventually he's going to turn. So when he turns, you know, then you can kind of change the game up, and maybe he's going to turn when he can't smell you no more. First thing that a buck does when they can't smell you is they're going to go left to right, usually to a high spot. Might be a short ridge, might be a mountain or knoll or anything, but they're going to go to a vantage point where they can look back at you on his track. And lots of times they'll go behind a blowdown or something, and they'll look through a hole that'll be the size of a coffee cup with their eye, and they know just where they came from. So they'll just watch that backtrack until they see movement, and they really don't even want it. They don't even have to see you. They just see a pant leg or whatever movement, and they know you are following them. So boom, they're off and they're running again. So after hundreds of, and I mean literally hundreds of bucks that I tracked, and I just jumped them and jumped them all day long, I got smarter as I got older, which we all do, and I started leaving the track. And every time I come to a spot where there was a ridge or something ahead of me, and I knew that buck was headed up to that ridge, I would always go downwind. So I'm down. You don't want to be upwind, because as you're crossing that line of sight where that buck is, where the wind would meet him, he's going to smell you and run. So I'd go downwind, make a loop, and it doesn't have to be a huge loop. You basically want to be out of sight and out of hearing, the two things. If they can't see you and they can't hear you, then they're still going to stand there and wait. So I'd make a quick loop around them, almost a fast pace, come around them, and I'd come around the back side of that ridge or knoll. And if I didn't cut their track on the snow, then I knew he was up there waiting for me. So then once I got, which I felt was beyond where he, and that's another thing. Guys ask me, well, how do you know how far to go? Well, it's just kind of a instinct thing where you think he is standing and where you think he might have crossed down over the ridge. I mean, you're wrong 50% of the time, but I tell everybody, you only got to be right once. And it works. So then I would start basically sneaking, just I call it the death walk, just sneaking back up towards the top of that ridge, watching every blowdown, every behind every tree, just looking to see if I could see an ear or a hindquarter or an antler or something. And I have shot probably at least a dozen 200-pound bucks in the last, 25 years doing that, leaving their track. And like I said, it's not a guaranteed thing, but when it all comes together and it works, it's the most satisfying hunt you'll ever do. Outsmarting that buck on his territory, on his turf, and being on his track and staying on his track. It's like a physical, mental challenge game all day long.
Nice. You've got a lot of them behind you to tell the story, so I get it.
There's a lot more in here. I'll turn a little bit. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow, yeah.
More over there in here. And yeah. I think I have I think I've got 48 in here, and I've got another 10 or so out in my off at my entryway, and then I've got some up at my cabin. So I probably had like, and I mount almost all the big bucks that I track if they're decent, like 135 inches or bigger. And, you know, 135 inch deer for up north is a pretty big buck, because they're mostly 8-pointers up north. And every now and then I'll run into a 10. I killed one 12 in Maine in my life. But yeah, it's pretty satisfying to outsmart one of those big deer on snow.
And oh, I bet.
Yeah, I've had some bucks, Heath, that I got one buck behind me there, and he's 6x6, the one up high. And I tracked him for the entire season one year. The first snowstorm we got was the very first week of November. Let's say it was the 4th or the 5th. And I found his track, and I tracked that buck all day, and I saw him twice. And when I saw him, I saw what he had for a rack, and I knew I wanted to kill him. And I probably had like 4 days that entire season that I couldn't track him. The snow melted, or it got real crusty and noisy, and the conditions just didn't work together for tracking. But I killed that buck on the very last day of muzzleloader season. So I tracked him for 5 weeks straight, and he weighed 178 pounds. And I think he definitely would have weighed around 215, 220 when I started on him early in the year. And, but I just never gave up on that buck. And how I finally killed him was I left his track, just like I talked about. Mm-hmm. That last day, I left his track, and I looked around a hardwood ridge. And as I came over the ridge, I was about 200 yards downwind of him. I come over the ridge, and he was on the next ridge over about 100 yards from me, walking with his head down. And I put a muzzleloader bullet right behind his shoulder.
Nice.
So, yeah.
So with your experience visual tracking, how does that relate to hounds? What are you seeing, like similarities? And then I want to, you know, you had said something else that was interesting about the coyotes, and we'll get back to that in just a minute.
Yeah. So I think all hunting ties together. And if you've hunted a bunch of different species, you've kind of figured that out as you get older. But, my visual tracking for bucks, and basically following bobcats, which you get on a bobcat track, and you usually follow that track until you freshen it up till the hound will take it, especially when they're young and you're training them, because not every dog will take a track at 20 below zero up here in Maine in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And you learn a lot of the habits, and what happens is the predators are usually the same place that the deer are, you know, because that's the food source for a predator. So you're always around the predators when you're always around big game, one or the other. So if you can usually find, if you're a coyote hunter or a bobcat hunter, and there's a deer yard around, that's where the majority of the predators are going to end up. So, you know, and I've followed coyotes for hundreds and hundreds of miles in my life with hounds, and coyotes and bobcats are two different species completely, the way they act, because a bobcat will get into a cedar swamp or something, or a rabbit thicket, and he might live right there for 2-3 days till he kills two or three rabbits and gets his belly full. And or the same thing with the deer yard. And
To explain us what a deer yard is. I know because I listened to another podcast, but just for the listeners that don't know what that is. Attention hound hunters and outdoor enthusiasts. Are you ready to experience the thrill of fair chase hunting? If so, check out Southern Hound Hunting Magazine. It's your ultimate guide to all forms of hound hunting, starting in the flat woods of southern Georgia and covering vast terrains across the nation. We bring you genuine stories where the chase is exhilarating as the catch, recipes, and the brag pages that follow. These adventures will take you down memory lane. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a newcomer to the sport, if it's hound worthy, we've got you covered. Join us in this heart-pounding world of hound hunting. To subscribe or to buy the latest swag, go to southernhoundhunting.com. You can also follow along on Facebook and Instagram, where the hunt never ends. Get ready for the real fair chase experience when you join the pack here at Southern Hound Hunting Magazine.
Right. I take it for granted that everybody knows what a deer yard is, because I grew up with deer yards. So up here in Maine, a deer yard, when the snow starts coming in you know, usually it's early December. We start getting some pretty heavy snow. And once I'd say you get the first six, 8 inches of snow, sometimes it's maybe a foot. All our deer within probably a 20-mile radius, most of the deer, not all of them, some come from 60 miles away, they say, up north. They've collared them and tracked them. But they all go to a common yard in the winter. And it's usually where it used to be years ago before we had so much forestry cut off. They cut off a lot of our deer yards and ruined them because they wanted the spruce. So the deer, like a tall, tall conifer that holds the snow up in a canopy above it. So you'll have sometimes between 200 and 500 deer, it used to be years ago, in a yard, in a huge, huge, you know, spruce bog and cedar bogs. And they change their diet over and they actually eat that conifer in the wintertime. And their bellies are designed for that up here. So... and they'll eat little hardwood shoots and all that. So they cut off a lot of the deer yards over the years. And so what's happened now is we have a lot of deer yards where people feed them, like up in the Forks, let's say, in Jackman. A lot of people in town feed the deer. So they've, over time, they've learned to all migrate as generations and generations of deer have evolved. Now they migrate to the towns, and we find... very few yards, you know, out in the woods anymore. That I think they're starting to come back a little, but they don't have much of a chance because they don't really name deer yards on the forestry maps anymore because they've cut so many of them off. And as they start growing back, they cut them. So you get around these little towns and maybe even the lakes and rivers, especially because this is another tactic. And this works during hunting season is deer use water to get away from coyotes or wolves, let's say. And so we get a lot of our deer yards near rivers because rivers very seldom freeze. They'll freeze up when it's 20 below zero. They might freeze for a day or two or three. Then they'll open right back up because of the current. So when a coyote starts chasing the deer or a group of coyotes start chasing the deer and they're trying to hamstring him, they will run to the river and they'll swim the river, which a coyote doesn't like to get wet when it's below zero. They'll freeze right up and they can't shake it off. Their hair's not hollow like a deer, you know? So a deer's hair is hollow. They float and they kind of shake the water right off and they dry out quick, whereas a coyote doesn't. So they use these rivers to get away from the predators all the time. And bobcats more or less jump onto a deer, maybe out off of a tree. I've seen with blowdowns and stuff where a bobcat would set on that blowdown on a deer trail in one of these yards in the winter. And in the wintertime, the deer will have these yards and there'll just be hundreds and hundreds of packed down trails all through these yards. And the yard, let's say a deer yard, the average deer yard is probably a mile by a mile or maybe a mile by 2 miles along a river or something. There'll be a town there where everybody feeds them. And all the bucks, everything will come and yard there for the winter. So the predators are constantly chasing them in these yards 24/7. And even the bobcats, they're around these yards all the time and trying to kill a deer. And, you know, you'd be surprised. A 20-pound bobcat can kill a 100-pound deer pretty easy. They just jump onto their neck. And same idea as a lion does. A bobcat always kills a deer and they bite him in the back of the neck. You know, that nerve paralyzes them and they die. Yeah. But to get back to the river thing. So late season, some of my favorite spots are near rivers and near the deer yards in Maine, because these bucks will migrate. They follow the does is what they do because that second rut is coming on in late season. So the habits will change. This happens in the Adirondacks too, where all the deer migrate out of the Adirondack Mountains and they go down towards towns and rivers. So that's a great spot for anybody that hasn't gone and hunted up north late season, like you want a muzzleloader hunt, a late rifle season. I always look at maps no matter where I go, and I'm going to go hunt near a river. And I'll almost always find a big buck if I'm hunting somewhere near a river, because like I said, the does are coming first and the bucks are going to follow them, guaranteed.
So the coyotes, back to the coyotes. So the, when you're, you said you run a lot of coyotes, what, when, so you've seen the deer tracks, you know where the deer's live and you know where they're doing. When you're running hounds on those coyotes, how is that equating to what you've seen visually? Are those dogs running the same corridors? Are they, I know you just said they're, you know, water. And I it's strange that you say that, because I don't know anything about coyote hunting with hounds. Mine run them on accident. I don't want them running them.
Yeah.
But I know when we're running a yote and my dogs don't, that when that keeps coming to water and circling, or it won't go to, in my mind, it's a yote.
Yeah.
And it's funny when you said that, because I'm like, he's confirming what I already thought. I didn't have any knowledge of it.
Yeah. So we hunted coyotes. I don't know. I started running. I always ran cats my whole life. Cats is my main love for hound hunting is cats. Mm-hmm. And I ran bears for a lot of years from the time I was in my teens, you know, right up through. And I don't really run bears anymore. I have to kind of pick and choose what I do. So I just don't have the time anymore. But running coyotes, I got back into that about 2000, about the year 2000, when we lost our deer herd. And we had so many coyotes, they were just killing our deer off in numbers. So I bought some hounds. And I started running coyotes. I was one of the first guys in the state of Maine to run coyotes. And everybody and their brother wanted to go with me. So I took a lot of guys. And a lot of those guys today have their own hounds. So I kind of feel like I was, you know, the start of all these guys coyote hunting. I was kind of like the father of it, that maybe brought it on. Not just me and a few other guys. But there was only a handful of us in the whole state. And I mainly hunted coyotes off of a snowmobile. That was my main thing to do during the wintertime, because I ran a construction business all summer. And I was busy, busy, busy all summer long, 7 days a week. And then I deer hunted in the fall. So in the wintertime, I'd lay my whole crew off. And so we can't hunt Sundays up here. So we could hunt 6 days a week. And so we put dog boxes on a snowmobile, and I'll send you a picture after, so maybe you can show that.
Okay, I will.
I got these little metal dog boxes we bought from somebody out west that makes them, and we mounted them right on the tunnel of our sled. And all us guys own mountain sleds, so they're like 155 inch tracks on them with a paddle track, because we get a lot of snow up here in Maine. You're trying to get around the woods and around the mountains. So we'd set those right on the tunnel, and I could put two hounds in my box, and my buddy would put two hounds in his box. And so we'd go up around the deer yards, and we've done this for years. And we'd go up around the deer yards, make a huge loop, and you'd see let's say we saw two fresh coyote tracks going into the deer yard. So we'd make a big loop around the deer yard, and if those coyote tracks weren't coming out, or you know, or you'd count them. You'd say, okay, there's three going in. There's only one coming out. We knew there was two coyotes in there. So you'd try to hunt where you could get around with a snowmobile, which most of Maine's got trails everywhere. And so we'd let the hounds go on one of those tracks. And back when I first started, I had this dog, Tink, that was probably, when I think back about it, he was probably the best dog I ever owned in my life. He was part foxhound and a part walker. He was a white with brown patches on him. And he had the coldest nose I ever seen in my life. I mean, 20, 30 below zero, you'd put him on a coyote track and he'd cold trail it until he jumped it. And so to get back, once we'd put the dog in there and he'd stop barking, we knew we jumped the coyote then. And so we'd go back to these same deer yards, you know, like year after year after year. We had like seven or eight deer yards that we hunted. And you'd go to a deer yard and there'd be about 10 coyotes in that deer yard, let's say, because the more dominant coyotes would keep the smaller ones out. So at the beginning of the year, the biggest coyotes we killed were always the beginning of the season in every deer yard. And then the next batch of coyotes, we'd clean that deer yard out of coyotes. Let's say there was 8 or 10 coyotes that were manning that deer yard killing deer. We'd kill those bigger coyotes, which they might range from 35 to 46 pounds. Let's say that was an average large coyote in Maine. The biggest one I ever killed was 56 and a half. And so we'd kill that batch of coyotes out of there, and then we'd go back, and the next batch of coyotes would be like 28 to 35 pounds. They'd be like, you know, a 1-year-old mm-hmm. coyotes, or maybe that year's pups. So it's funny how they're very territorial. They're very dominant. The older ones kind of control what the younger ones do. So I think that's why coyotes range so much, is once they're born, the parents kick them out because that's their range. You got to go find your own. And so over time, hunting these coyotes, we found we were always killing them in the same spots. Like there might be a frozen brook that would run up through a bunch of alders, and they'd run right up that brook with the dog. So, you know, after like 2 or 3 times of hunting every spot, we'd go back and the guys would, I'd send them to these spots. I said, okay, go down in that. There's a big rock down in that valley. You'll see where the snowmobile trail comes to it. And there's a brook right there with a bridge. And I said, park your sled and just stand right there. And year after year after year, you know, we'll kill coyotes in the same spot over and over. And so that, you know, they do have generation after generation after generation, they have a pattern that they're all going to follow. And it's because of the terrain. And deer are the same way. I think mm-hmm. bear, anything. The terrain is what drives where they're going to go.
So that leads me to another question.
Yeah.
So you're running yotes, you're running cats, and you've run bear. So what type of dog was you running on the yotes compared to, for me, in my mind, you're looking at 3 different style of dogs. Can you break each individual, like the dogs, down for each game that you're pursuing?
Yeah. I don't want my coyote dogs running, switching over to a cat, and I don't want my cat dog switching over to a coyote. So you got to break them up that, which all hound hunters know how we, you know, you're either with a shock collar or you're going to scold them, one or the other. And so you try to break them for only running one species is what all the hounds I ever had only ran one species. I say that I did have a few coyote hounds that ran bear as well. Mm-hmm. And they were good bear dogs, actually. But in the wintertime, you're not going to find a bear up here in Maine out on the snow, hardly ever. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe once every 5 years. But so they differentiate the tracks, and they'll just run one game species. I always ran running walkers on coyotes. A running walker is a walker, but he's thinner. They got more lung capacity than a treeing walker. And they're just a narrower dog, a little bit taller, it seems like. And they had more, like I said, more lungs. A coyote, some days we'd put 22, 24 miles on one coyote sometimes before we killed them. And once you learn all the crossings and you hunt the same place over and over, it gets so easy. It seemed like it got so easy to kill them because we knew all the crossings. And we had more guys coming, too, that wanted to go and shoot them with us. So you'd try to cover all the crossings, and it shortened a lot of the runs up. Sometimes we'd kill 4 or 5 by noon. You know, we'd clean the place out, and then we'd have to load up and go somewhere else.
What kind of dogs were you running on cats?
Me and my buddy Sandy and I cat hunted for, I don't know, 35 years together. And we run mainly plots. And I had a leopard cur that was my Luxie dog. And that was, she was a phenomenal dog. And we bred a lot of cross dogs, which were half beagle, half plot. Those cross dogs seemed to be some of the best hounds on cats we ever owned. And
what was the thought? And I know Cleve and Becky Dwyer out west, they are crossing beagles into their dogs for cat. They're hunting lion. What was your thought process, and what traits was it that you were looking for to, when you made that cross?
Yeah, beagles always start at a younger age, for one thing. Okay, a beagle at 4 months old, I've had beagles running rabbits, six months old running rabbits, and beagles have a colder nose. So you're going to breed that early starting and the colder nose into that plot hound or whatever hound you're trying to breed. Mm-hmm. So I just think that and from everything I read over the years, when you cross two hounds for the very first time, you get the best traits out of both dogs. When you cross them the second time, like if you try to do that again, it seems like you never get what you had. And that's from experience, from breeding and all the pups we've ever had. It seems like when you cross bloodlines that very first time, they're a very smart dog. And you think about it, like a lot of, I've seen over the years in my whole life, I've seen dogs that we'd call a mutt or a mongrel because they're crossbred. Mm-hmm. And they'd be one of the smartest house pets somebody I knew ever had. You know, it was like you could talk to them almost. And that's because I think when you cross those dogs for the very first time, the best traits come out.
Yeah.
There was a guy that wrote a book on that. I can't think of it right now, but he wrote a book on crossing hounds, and that's where I read it.
Mm-hmm. So how do those dogs compare to the bear dogs you had or the bear dogs that you've hunted with? Cause I know a little bit about Kirk's dogs. I know what style and how they, you know, what they do.
Yeah. I hunted with Kirk for years and years. And, Kirk's dogs are very aggressive dogs. He's, Kirk doesn't put up with any bullshit with his hounds. They better be top notch or he's going to trade them out or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know? And, which I think a lot of us are that way. Some guys will hang on to dogs for years and years and years and never get a good dog out of them. They just think they're going to end up being a good dog. I'm kind of the same way. If a dog doesn't come into it within the first 2 years, I'll usually sell him or give him to somebody I know and mm-hmm. that doesn't expect what I do out of a hound, you know, just because maybe they haven't had as good a hounds as I've had my whole life. So I know what to expect. So I think everybody's hound level is a little bit different on whatever level of hunting you're on.
Yeah, yeah. I say that all the time. I'm like, what my definition of a hound is, what my expectation of a hound is, can be completely different than yours or everybody else's. And exactly. I think that's where we get chapped a little bit when you buy a dog from his person, you know, you say, okay, this dog's from truck to tree.
Yes.
My definition of truck to tree may be a lot different than what their definition of truck to tree is.
Yeah. I've bought a lot of hounds over the years that were all running, and some guy's definition of a good dog and mine, day and night.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I had, so that Tink dog I had, I grabbed a picture, but you know, after I had him for about 2 years, he was so good that we could go into a deer yard. And especially if you got 8 to 12 inches of fresh snow, that coyote, he wouldn't go anywhere. You'd watch him on the GPS and he'd go in on the track. And as soon as he made a loop and went back into his own track, you knew he was jumped right there. He might be out of hearing or out of range, but you'd watch him on the GPS. And as soon as he made that loop and he went back through his old line, you go jumped. He's jumped. So you get ready and you'd stand on the back track. So when you got 8 to 12 inches of snow, that coyote's breaking trail. He's breaking trail. So he's working hard and that dog is jumping in his track. So mm-hmm. he's going to catch him quick. And we had 1 week there in 4 days. We killed, I show you this picture, but in 4 days That was my barn wall. I think there's 16 or 17 there. So we cleaned two deer yards out, and we started seeing our deer yards just explode in numbers once we started running coyotes. Our deer yards went from when we lost all our deer back in the 2000s. We probably only had 50 deer that survived these hard winters because the coyotes had killed them all off. And it was mostly just the does because the bucks always die. They're the weakest up here in Maine. Once you go into a yard and the bucks rutted the whole season and you go into a hard winter, the bucks take it the worst. They've got no body fat.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we started seeing the deer numbers just start exploding and you know, fawns, they those started having twins and triplets again and all that. And we'd go in and clean these deer yards out. So finally our deer yards got back. So we had 200 or 300 deer in our yards like we do now. We got pretty good deer yards now again. But it took 15 or 20 years to get us back to where we are now.
Well, all right. So, and you just prompted another question. We're talking about the snow and the deep snow, and you had said it earlier. Once it gets down below zero, and you put out a number, I don't know if it's like 20 below or whatever.
Yeah.
But the dogs really can't trail at that point. So what temperature level? Let's go from 32. Let's go from freezing under. Okay. Let's go from freezing under. When was it that you saw the dogs struggle in the colder temperatures?
Just about, I would say about zero, it changes. Like just about any good hound, plot hound or a running walker I ever had that was we considered a cold-nosed dog.
Mm-hmm.
From zero above, you know, especially if a coyote track, coyotes have more scent, I think, than, they definitely have more scent than a cat. They're easy to follow because I had some dogs that would switch right over because there was so much scent on a coyote, they'd cross the track. We had to break them of it.
Uh-huh.
And, but about zero, they struggled. That Tink dog I told you about, I don't care if it was 20 or 30 below zero, that dog, you'd put him on a coyote track and you could put your bank account on it that he was going to come out with that coyote running. He's going to jump him if he was in that block of woods. So, you know, some dogs are better than others, absolutely. And I think the older they get, as they get older, I've seen some of my hounds, they get a colder nose. Like they might start out at 2 years old starting to learn how to cold trail. They start out at about a year old and we dump them in on a fresh, hot-going cat or a coyote, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. So they pack in or they get in there on a jumped cat, so they learn how to run that. Well, then once that older dog, let's say something happens, that older dog dies off or whatnot, because we only really you only get about 8 to 10 years out of a hound. We all know, you know, mm-hmm. That's about a lifespan of a really good hound, and then they kind of fall off. So you end up walking out a lot of tracks. So by walking out that cold track, this is what I do with the pups. I might have him on a leash or if he's easy to handle, he's a good handling dog, I'll just let him off the leash and he'll follow me. And if he gets off the track and I've got the track because I'll stay on it, I'll just keep calling him over. Like I'll squeal at him or whatever, like a cat, you know. And my dogs get used to me, you know, my style of calling him over. Everybody's got I hunt with different hound guys and they've all got their own call, you know. I kind of yip to my dogs and kind of like a coyote does. Mm-hmm. And I yip to them like that. And when they're struggling and they hear me yip, they know I've got the track. So they'll just come running right to us. And you put them back on the right track or the fresher track. Let's say I find it, trust it. Like he's on that cold track and the cat went out to the right. We might be in some ledges or something. And I'll kind of say, well, I'm not going to go up through there. I'll go around. And all of a sudden, I got the coyote or the cat track fresh.
Mm-hmm.
He came around, so I'll yip to my dog. And sometimes there'll be a half mile or a mile out. But on a good cold day, that dog's going to hear you. I had a lot of them where they would just leave the track and come right to me. So by following that cold track and then actually jumping the cat or the coyote, you train that dog in his head that there is actually a run at the end of that cold track. So after, you know, like 3 to 4 times of doing that, they start to catch on. And then when you put them on the cold track, they'll start to go on their own. And then you gain confidence in your dog. So once he goes on his own, I'll still stay with him to make sure they don't get screwed up. But after like 4 or 5 times and he's going out and he gets a mile out away from me and I can't even catch him, I'll just go back to my snowmobile, you know, or back to the truck, whatever, and keep the GPS and try to, you know, if I get back on my sled, I'm going to try to go around the mountain or whatever and try to cut the distance down so I can keep my dog on the GPS and see where he is. So,
yeah, and that brings me to two points that I want to talk about. I think as a society, we've gotten lazy and taking advantage of that snow and walking those tracks out, even though you tell yourself mentally, I've got a dog, I shouldn't have to walk this out. But if I've got a young dog that's inexperienced, and you're right, if I get off my butt, get out of my truck, and I start, you know, help, and I hate the word to use, I'm assisting that dog in a learning behavior. Right. So I'm going to take advantage of that track. I'm going to take advantage of that snow. And I used to do that a lot when I was, you know, young, when I was a lot younger, because I didn't have, you know, I didn't know things and I didn't I didn't have the dogs that I have now or the experience that I have now. And
right.
My dogs, and this is, I'm going to roll this over to the second point. You know, my dogs would flat out trail back then, but to add to that, we've got a lot more bear now. Population is a lot thicker and more dense than it was, you know, 20 years ago.
And then I want to
hit on the what you said, Rick, because a cold trailing dog, we've had this discussion on this podcast. We debate this all the time. And I was going to bring this up at a later date, but since you mentioned it, I'm going to dive into it. And before we get off here, is when you talk about coyotes, those coyotes are staying in that deer yard because their chance of survival increases 10 times because there's food there.
Right. That's the food source. Right.
And if you look at a wild pack, whether it be wolves or coyotes, when you talk about trailing, the pack's instinct is to take the freshest track. If I take the freshest track, my chances of survival of feeding myself is a lot more guaranteed.
Oh, absolutely.
So then we're going to go back to the trailing. And I've been battling this with my group of dogs that I'm running right now, is my dogs like to run. They like to get up and they like to run. And I've got a quarter running dog in my dogs. When you talked about that, mine are quarter running dog, three quarter trend. So that's what my mix is. So my dogs, and I talked about it on an earlier podcast, my dog would stick his nose down in a track in the snow. He'd go 200 or 300 yards, he'd turn and come back. And I got very frustrated this winter thinking that I need to change my pack up a little bit. I need to do things a little different. And then I sat through a webinar with Jeff Shetler, who teaches a canine law enforcement canine tracking class. And Jeff brought up the point that I already knew and that you're just talking about with, you know, with the wild animals, is you were trying to get, we as hunters, hound hunters, we want our dogs to do something that's unnatural. We want our dogs to take the deer that come through that yard 12 hours ago and not take the deer that come through that yard 5 hours ago, because the 5 hours guarantees me a meal. The 12 hours is it's a chance. It's a shot in the dark. I may or may not catch it. And right. Dogs, what you just said, dogs are smart. Like, dogs know, you said it, and I was like, yes. When you talked about knowing that there is a chase at the end of that cold track, and we condition our dogs to run the hotter track, we ask our dogs to do something that's unnatural genetically, to take an older track. And when we get frustrated with our dogs or we don't understand behavior, it sets up a bad relationship with the hound. And I got frustrated. And when I sat through that thing with Jeff a couple months ago, I'm like, I've talked, me and him's actually had this conversation before. I know what he's saying, and I know this. And I put it in the back of my mind, and I let it get away to me until he refreshed my memory that dogs, domesticated dogs, take the easy path.
Yeah.
The wild dogs are going to take an easy path because they're going to catch that deer that is easy to catch.
Right.
And I think, you know, it's something that we need to sit back and look at and take a better overall view of what we're asking our dogs to do. I want my dogs to trail. And if I'll get out of my truck and walk a couple of those, like you said, three or four of those tracks, and they start understanding that if I keep on and keep on and keep on, there's going to be a reward at the end of it, then I'm going to have better dogs.
That your dog is going to gain more confidence in a quicker period of time by you helping him, because you know you get a lot of dogs and they'll be on a, let's say you get on a cold track and they'll smell it a little bit and they'll get all excited when you let them out of the truck and like you said, they'll go about 100 yards and then they'll just look back. Then they turn around, come back to you. So when I, you know, especially a young dog, I put my snowshoes on or whatever, and you're sitting there thinking, boy, it'd be easy if I just sat here on my snowmobile or by the truck or whatever and my GPS and let him go. And that's the thing about hound hunting is once you've trained a hound to get to the point where he can do it all himself, it's a very short window. Mm-hmm. We got four or five years of maybe taking it easy. So you've always got to train pups coming along. So, and that's why it's important too, to always have a pup to go along with a 5-year-old
mm-hmm.
that knows the game to teach that pup, because, and it doesn't always work that way, but you still got to help that pup. And what it does, it gains that dog's confidence 10 times over. If you just put a little effort into going with him. And the other thing that it does, it builds a relationship between you and that hound. And you don't see it. It's hard to see it unless you're a hound hunter and you own your own dogs. And once you've gone with him on the track and worked it all out and all that, and you know, you can just see the difference in that dog. Some people won't even see it because they're not a hound hunter, you know. But mm-hmm. being a hound hunter, it's all about the dogs, really, than the kill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the hound hunter, a houndsman, I should say, a guy that owns the hounds. Whereas if you've got a client or just somebody going along, they don't understand that. But the relationship you build with that hunting hound is it's hard to understand, but that dog gets confidence through you. So when you let him go and then once he kills it, or, you know, he runs that and you kill that cat or that coyote or bear, whatever, and you're praising him up at the end of it, and he's sitting there, you know, and he knows he did a good job. So the next time you let him go, he's going to be a little bit better. And the mm-hmm. next time you let him go, he's going to be a little bit better. And then I've noticed with hounds, like young dogs, you don't really think they're getting that much better. Like you'd be running them for a week straight and you'll think, wow, he's not really coming into it. And then all of a sudden it's like, boom, the light bulb comes on and he just doubled his, you know, confidence, nose, running ability. He doesn't lose the track and he's not missing corners on the track and all that and searching and things change quick. But it is all about the more time you put in with them, the better they're going to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So let's finish this with, tell me about one of your favorite bear hunts. And like I said, I see you got that 502 pounder sitting behind you.
Yeah.
Beautiful animal.
Yeah.
Let's end it on one of your best bear hunts.
Well, so probably one of my best bear hunts was not mine, but it was my daughter. When she was 15, Sierra, and Kirk was there with me on this one. And this was one of the most memorable hunts I think I ever been on. But I pulled Sierra out of school that day, and I talked to Kirk the night before, and he says, "Oh, I got a really big bear." And I think that bear weighed 384 when we weighed him. He was a big bear. And so he says, "Yeah, I got a really big bear hitting the bait." And Jimmy was there with us, and my buddy Sandy went, and Sierra. So we went up to a bait, and we let the dog go that morning, and he cold trail away, and then pretty soon he jumped. So we cut in, I don't know, three or four more hounds, and they run him up around the mountain, and then pretty soon they were treed. So Kirk says, "Yeah, he's treed." He goes, "The only way in here is by backpack." He says, we gotta hike in and walk up over this mountain." And we get up top of the mountain, and dogs were treeing pretty good. We get up top of this mountain, and there was an ash tree that was one of the biggest ash trees I've ever seen in my life. It was probably 4 foot at the butt, and it grew out at an angle over this mountain. So it didn't grow up straight. It grew out at an angle kind of with the mountain, almost like it started to blow over, and then it root system took over and it held it. And it had these striped maples, which a striped maple, we got them. They grow up a lot in Maine, like where you've had a clear cut and stuff, like after 10 years. And they're about 2 inches, 3 inches in diameter. They never really get any bigger. And they got these huge, huge maple leaves on the top. And this was, I think, right around the 1st of October. So the leaves hadn't even fallen off the trees yet. So we get up there, and nobody could see the bear because of those striped maples. And we had my daughter, Sierra, with us. And so we get up. And you could lean on that tree and look right up the tree. And there's this, you know, almost 400-pound bear up the tree. And you could see him. And he was looking back over his shoulder, looking down the tree like this, hanging on. And so we all looked at him. We all said, "Yeah, that's a big bear. That's the one. That's the one's been hitting that bait." So I looked at Sierra and I said, "Okay." I said, "I want you to shoot him right in the eye." He's looking down. I said, "Shoot him in the left eye." And she was a really good shot. So we all pulled the dogs back, tied them to the trees like we always do. And I said, "I'll get under the tree." And I had my 44 Magnum. So she shoots, and I'm standing under the tree with my pistol like this. And I'm kind of back like 10 feet from where I think he's going to fall, and nothing happens. And out of my peripheral vision, I see Sandy grab Sierra, and he throws her right in midair. And gun and all, right? He throws her. And when he did, that bear comes and whoom, hits the ground so hard, just like a Volkswagen. And he bounced and he rolled. Well, where Sierra threw Sandy, he threw her downhill towards Kirk. And she went into those striped maples, so she couldn't go very far. That bear hit the ground, rolls onto her.
Mm.
And she hit him right in the eye, right where I told her, and killed him. Well, what he did is, he held on, and she, when she killed him, he just died instantly. He didn't even move, and it was slow motion. He just kind of came loose, and then he fell backwards.
He rolled off.
He saw him coming backwards, and he hit the tree and bounced to come down. Hit the tree once, bounced, come down, and Sandy saw what was going, so he threw Sierra. And so that bear rolls on to Sierra. Kirk's down below Sierra. Kirk grabs Sierra. This all happened in 3 seconds, right? Yeah. He pulls Sierra out, and her boots come off underneath the bear. He run up. He gave him one in the head again, shot him right in the side of the skull. And so anyway, we went back home, and I told her, I says, "You can't tell your mother this story." She was going to freak out. So Sierra comes home. She goes, Nancy says, "Wow, you got a big bear, Sierra." She goes, "That's a giant." And she says, "Yeah." She goes, "It was the coolest story, Mom." She goes, "The bear fell out of the tree and he rolled onto me. Kirk pulled me out and my boots were underneath him." And she looks at me like,
"Never again."
So anyway, that's all, you know, I got 25 stories like that, but that was probably the most memorable one.
Yeah, it's always, I mean, my daughter hunts with me, and that's my best hunts.
Yeah.
Regardless of what happens, it's just being in the woods with her and enjoying those experiences and making those memories that they'll never forget.
Oh, absolutely. My girls growing up, they both shot 200-pound bucks. They both shot a pile of big bucks. And I used to hunt with them every chance I got. And there was a time there from like when they were like 14 or 15 till 20. I don't even think I shot a 200-pound buck for like 4 or 5 years because I spent so much time hunting with my girls because I knew that that time was going to end. And,
right.
And as soon as they turned, I don't know, about 18, that was it. You know, they were gone.
I got four more years then. Four more years.
Yeah. Enjoy every minute of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You'd be glad you did. But I'll tell you one more bear story. This is funny with Kirk Rogers.
All right. So
we're running a bear up in the county, and it was I thought I had a picture of it on the wall here somewhere, but this bear weighed 4-something, and we were running him up in the county in Maine in those potato fields. And I was probably 2 miles away, and I saw him come out across the potato field, and he had the whole pack of hounds behind him, and they were hanging off his ass and everything and going right at it. And so I looked at my GPS, and I said, there's a logging road right there. So because we're hunting in unfamiliar territory up there where we were, up on these ridges with these paper company logging roads. So I headed down this logging road. I come to a T. I took a left because I knew the bear was beyond that, and he was kind of paralleling it. I drove down there about a half mile, and I jumped out. I listened, and I could hear the hounds right up above me on the ridge, probably 200 yards, and I could hear them coming. So I had a 45-70, and I had one of those Marlin 45-70 guide guns. And I used to carry that in a 44 Magnum pistol when we were bear hunting. So I bailed out of the truck, and I struck off up through that ridge running, and the dog was just ahead of the bear was just ahead of the dogs. And so I shot him. And when I did, I heard Kirk holler, and he was above, you know, like a couple hundred yards up through the woods above me coming down. He says, "Did you get him?" I said, "Yeah, I think I got him." And dogs, you know, as soon as you fire a shot, the dogs pile right on a bear. That's just from anything. Well, the bear wasn't dead. You know, I shot him through the shoulders, but he wasn't dead. And just as I'm getting to the bear, Kirk comes running down. And he's got his handgun out, and the bear's got one dog on the ground kind of cradled in there. And Kirk jumps on the bear, and he puts his handgun right on his head. And as soon as Kirk put that handgun on that bear's head, the bear flips over, and his teeth are right between Kirk's legs, and he almost got him in the gonads, snapping at him, and Kirk's jumping in the air. He fired a shot right in the head and finished him, killed him. But he got off of there, and he goes, "Holy mackerel, do you see how close that was to losing my family jewels?" It was close.
I mean, everybody's got story like too close for comfort stories.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. Yeah. I've had some bucks that I've gotten a few rides on that I thought were dead and walked up to and grabbed their horns, and they jumped up on me, and I was trying to hold them down, and I ended up grabbing my rifle, shooting them again or something. That's happened a few times over the years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Rick, I really appreciate you spending your afternoon with me and kind of leading us through this. And like I said, it's always good to learn something new, and I hope people can take something from it. But like I said, just your tracking and seeing how animals operate, that intrigued me. And
yeah, I got a lot of really good deer tracking videos, and I kind of film myself when I'm on a buck track.
Where can we find those at?
You can Google it on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
Put on Rick Labby, Big Woods Bucks.
Yep.
Or just Rick Labby. I got a buck I killed. That buck on the wall hanging straight behind me.
He's a beauty.
Yeah, that's I nicknamed him Slewfoot because he had a crooked toe,
mm-hmm.
kind of slewed in. So I named him Slewfoot. And I tracked him for 2 days, and I got a pretty good video where I crossed a river 3 times. And
oh, nice.
Yeah, I dumped my boots out, dumping all the water out, wringing my socks, putting my wool pants back on. It was, you know, like 10 above zero, and stayed right on his track for 3 or 4 more hours, and I finally killed him. But that's a really good video, one of my favorite ones. And then the buck I killed this year in Maine, we called it number 45. It was my 45th 200-pounder. in my life. So that's a really good video. I filmed that myself, and so that's a good video. It came out really good.
Well, good. Yeah, I'll add that when I do the show notes and we post it. I'll add that on the bottom of it. And
yeah,
that way people can look, and you can always catch him on Big Woods Bucks. I mean, there's other podcasts that he's on, but those YouTube videos of tracking would be super interesting.
Yeah, I love video. I love tracking. That tracking's my favorite mm-hmm. thing to do. Yeah, I killed some lions out west. I killed 3 mountain lions out west over the years, and never took my own hounds. I always hunted with other guys out there, but that was a lot of fun running lions. We probably ran and baited up over a dozen over the years, and I killed 3 myself.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, very nice. Well, like I said, I appreciate you coming on, spending your time with me, and thank you for helping us teach, train, and learn.
Yeah, I'm glad to be on. Thanks a lot, Heath. I really appreciate it.